listening to a CNBC TV 18 podcast. Hello and welcome. You've tuned in to CNBC TV 18, and this is the Smooth Ride podcast with me, Alisha Sachdev, where we talk about all things auto. In today's edition of the podcast, we're going to talk about what challenges the auto sector is currently facing during the second wave of COVID-19, how these challenges are different from those last year. We'll try to read market sentiment and also discuss what the big themes in auto will be for 2021. Now, my guest on the podcast today is Rajiv Singh, partner and automotive sector leader at Deloitte, who spent over 20 years working with some of the largest manufacturers globally for their India entry strategies. And he continues to advise auto companies on the future of mobility. Rajiv, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks, Alisha.
To start with, Rajiv, let's address the one question in auto everyone finds most important and also most difficult to read: sentiment. In 2020, we were dealing with the pandemic for the first time, and for auto, it meant addressing very fundamental questions. How do we keep up production? Can buyers come to showrooms? Can they take test drives? And now the questions are very different, and people are also feeling more strained due to how severe this virus has been. So how do you read into market sentiment at this moment?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Alisha, for starting with the customer out here. And let's try and delve a little more into wave one and then come to wave two. So when the wave one hit us exactly or a little more than a year back, maybe January, February, I think we need to keep in mind that that it was not just a India phenomena, but it was a global phenomena. So when you think from an auto perspective, it was not just players in India, but it was the global players all across getting a hit. And hence the supply chain disruptions were significantly higher because the disruptions were seen across US, across Europe, across Asia, across India, and so on. Also, because being the first wave, uncertainties were very, very high. We didn't know really what to expect. And the health concerns were also very, very high amongst various geographies. But come a year down the line now in wave two, a couple of things slightly differently. I think that from a perspective of policymakers, from a perspective of manufacturers and so on, I think there is a lot of learning that they had out of the wave one. And hence, they seem to be feeling a little more better prepared in terms of what actions to take. And at the same time, they think that at least they can move in swiftly in terms of taking some corrective actions suddenly if, say, a geography comes under a lockdown, say. So things are a little more better planned, I would say, from a perspective of the government, the policymakers, when it comes to, say, manufacturing and distribution, I'm talking about specifically, and also from a perspective of OEMs. But from a consumer perspective, a lot of things are also very, very different this time. Last time within India, if you saw, the wave one largely was something that hit the urban economy in a major manner. The rural economy, fortunately for us, was a little protected last time. And that's the reason you saw that the two-wheelers and the tractor industry really saw a big boom in terms of demand and so on and so forth, while overall there was a big hit in terms of entire pandemic hitting the urban areas. But this time, Alisha, if you see, the wave two is not restricted only to the urban areas. Actually, it has gone deep, deep into the rural areas in the country. So hence, I believe that this time it's going to be more severe from a consumer sentiment perspective, Alisha.
That's right. Rural India has not been protected from COVID this time, and the economy there will suffer as a result, which means demand will be impacted. And not only in rural India, but we're seeing this in lower income groups in urban regions too. In this backdrop, what will the recovery picture look like when things start to settle down?
I think when people are talking of recovery, people are talking of different scenarios. Because honestly, when people are doing their budgeting and they're planning for the next 1 year, next 2 years, it's very difficult to say what will we be able to do at the end of the, say, the fiscal year. So people are planning themselves by creating scenarios, say that, okay, if this wave two gets over, say, probably by mid-July, or end July, then how does the year, the balance amount of time in this year looks like? And at the same time, if there are talks of wave three, and we still don't know how severe wave three will be, and what is the exact timing that wave three is likely to hit us, then what is it that we will be able to do in that scenario? So I think that people are hence focusing more in terms of looking at scenario-based planning at this point in time. Depending on what scenario emerges, they are trying to say what kind of an outlook for the market they would have. But collectively, one thing is certain that this year is going to be a little more challenging as compared to last year as well. So while last year already the commercial vehicle sector, the four-wheelers, the two-wheelers, the tractor industry, except the tractor, so let's forget the tractor for the time being, which saw growth of about 15-16%. Rest all three segments, from a retail perspective, definitely saw a dip. From a retail perspective, even two-wheelers saw a significant dip. Maybe that some of the OEMs were able to meet up to their manufacturing numbers or production numbers, but the wholesale numbers and the retail numbers are very, very different. And that's the reason that from a retail perspective, there was certainly a dip in two-wheelers as well. Four-wheelers, commercial vehicles, significant dip. So this year, people do expect that it's going to be a little more challenging as compared to last year. So let's brace for that challenging times ahead, I think.
This year is more challenging compared to last year. That seems to be the clear conclusion here. But speaking of the positives, there was a universal trend that we saw towards personal mobility last year onwards as people felt scared to move around in public transport or share vehicles. Rajiv, to your mind, is this a trend that will sustain beyond the pandemic? Once the fear starts to go away, do you think people will still continue to hold on to wanting to travel in their own personal vehicles?
So, Alisha, a very difficult question, Alisha. Really, very difficult to get into future and say what will happen given so much of uncertainty around us. But I can just share a few observations.
Maybe a good way to look at this is to see if automakers are actually strategizing for personal mobility in the long term.
Yeah, so I'll just come in terms of what we saw, say, in short term, which was last year, and what people are doing this year. So very clearly, Alicia, when we went to the consumers and we spoke to thousands of consumers in India, and this was in the month of December, January. So wave one had got over, and wave two had not yet set in. So I'm talking about that particular period. We found that about 25% of the consumers said that, see, they are not going to change their timing of buying a new vehicle. So they said that, if I plan to buy a new vehicle in the next 6 months, 1 year, I'm still going ahead by the same decision. 25% of the people said that. 37% of the people said that I'm going to postpone my decision of buying a vehicle. But what was interesting is that a little more than that, 38% people said that I'm preponing the decision of buying a vehicle. So we had a slightly higher percentage, or a slightly, maybe whatever, not significantly higher, but you can say that there was a sizable number of people, 38% people, who said, we want to prepone the decision of buying a vehicle, which indicated that there was definitely a shift towards personal mobility. Now, if I correlate this with another data that we had asked the consumers, we heard about 70% of the consumers showing concerns on traveling by the metro trains or by public transportation system or by all these Ola, Uber cabs and so on, the radio cabs that we have, which clearly indicated that there are a large number of people, and this 70% was cutting across age groups. So it was not that 70% was largely like people only 55 or 45 and above. Even youngsters who are in, say, 25 to 35 and so on, even they showed a lot of concerns in terms of traveling by the Ola, Uber, or by the public transportation system. We believe that this is what, as a consumer behavior, probably would have driven the demand that we saw for four-wheelers and two-wheelers in the festival season, which was in October, November, December, and which continued till about January, February. Now, reading into the past, we believe that this is likely to continue even in the future, at least for some time, till the fear of the pandemic continues. So if the fear of the pandemic continues for another, say, maybe a couple of years, and hope it gets over faster. But say if it continues for another couple of years, we do believe that this trend of moving away from shared mobility towards personal mobility is likely to continue. The key difference, however, is going to be that this 38% of the people who wanted to prepone also wanted to buy more frugal vehicles or vehicles at a lower budget. So the price points for which the demands are likely to go up are going to be lower, but definitely there will be a demand for personal mobility, which is a shift slightly backwards from shared mobility for the next couple of years.
Right, and before the pandemic, there was incredible traction towards shared mobility. Millennials and the younger generations, in fact, did not want to invest in a car as an asset. The convenience of shared mobility was the overarching trend before the virus hit. But for the next couple of years, personal mobility, like you're saying, will reign. So are manufacturers then strategizing for shared mobility or personal mobility?
So from a long-term perspective, Alisha, people do believe that shared mobility is here to continue. And given that the way millennials think, and I'm unfortunately beyond that now, but whatever we keep talking to the youngsters and keep trying to understand, what we hear them usually talk about is less of money that they would want to spend on owning something. And that gives them higher flexibility. And it's not just cars for that matter. It could be anything. It could be even, for example, homes. Rather than buying homes, they would be more happier to rent out homes, for example. Okay, it gives them more flexibility in terms of moving from one geography to another geography. In fact, I was surprised, and I must say this as a personal experience. I have a daughter, and at age of 17, 18, last year, she was saying that in a wedding, why do I need to stitch something? Can I get something which I can just hire? Because I'll use it only once, and after that, I'm not going to use it again. Of course, it's very difficult for us to come to terms with the way the millennials think. But I think that is what is going to drive the millennial behavior. So from a long-term perspective, Alisha, I think most of the OEMs, rather I would say all the OEMs do have strong plans when it comes to shared mobility. They're looking at leasing, for example, as an option and so on. But at the same time, they have to keep the business running. So it's like keeping both the sides lights on for some time. So they are looking at how to drive or cash on this particular opportunity, which is there, where people are trying to look at personal mobility as a choice. But at the same time, how to ensure that the business models and the plans that they have from a shared mobility also at the same time keep running in.
Interesting. Rajiv, what about the two-wheeler buyer now, or what we call the commuter segment buyer in India? Now, these are people who buy two-wheelers for personal mobilities, often also for the lack of other viable modes of transport. And this is the segment of the population, the lower middle classes or the blue-collar worker, etc., which have been hit the hardest with income uncertainties. They have gone through layoffs. So how do you view the risks to this segment at this point?
I think that risk is real in nature. It's very difficult to assess at this point in time the kind of impact that the rural market must be undergoing. But given the kind of numbers that we keep hearing of how the pandemic has hit the rural market, the kind of fatalities that we are hearing, the loss of near and dear ones that we are hearing, I think that this is something that we need to really, really be worried about, because the rural economy really drove 60 to 70% of the sales for the mass two-wheelers, in a sense. And even in the passenger vehicles, actually the mass vehicles which are there, they are largely dependent on the rural economy to drive growth, because the top 10 cities were not really driving growth for the mass players. It was the rural economy which was driving growth for them. So that is why I think that this is going to be a real worry this year for some of the players, especially who are there in the mass market.
Mass market two-wheeler players have a cause for concern indeed. But from their commentary, we do hear of a positive outlook towards rural recovery, given they anticipate a normal monsoon for the third year and a good cash position in rural households. So do you think these factors are enough to offset the risks that we just discussed?
So in the long term, when I say long term, at this point in time, long term is also just 2 years. Okay, I think next year, probably it'll definitely bounce back, given that the savings, household savings are higher at this point in time. But in the short term, which is in the next, say, festival, which is about to be, say, 5-6 months from now. And let's keep in mind that for the festival, which starts, say, with Ganpati in Maharashtra, and then it just spreads all across the country, you find that the production really picks up from June, July onwards, because all the OEMs start to build stocks, which is just about one and a half months away from now, Alisha. So I think that from a perspective of this year festival season, it is going to be a little challenging unless and until we see a sudden, very sudden V-shaped recovery coming out of it. Okay, I think that this year, the festival season is not going to be like the last year festival season. For example, last year festival season, Arisha, we had a real good time. The two-wheelers, the four-wheelers, all of them really saw big recoveries to an extent that people were feeling that even if they have lost the entire quarter, first quarter of the year, they thought that they would still manage to cover up for an entire quarter. So that is the kind of recovery they saw. Unfortunately, at least I don't believe that kind of a recovery we are likely to see in this festival season in this year.
Sure, that does seem to be the case because of how severely people's lives have been impacted this time. But Rajiv, switching gears now, let's look at the year in rear view for a bit. 2020 has been a rocky year for the sector. It came with massive production and supply chain challenges, but it also showed good resilience in the festive season, for instance. Now, how different are things at this point in time, and what are some of the big challenges the auto sector faces currently?
See, I think some of the challenges that the sector faced in wave one will be there even in now in the current scenario, which is from a supply chain perspective, how do you ensure continuity in terms of flow of material? One of the other challenges that they faced in terms of migrant labor going back, I think that factor may not be here. That means that the tier one, and it didn't impact the OEMs directly, but indirectly, because it was the tier one, tier two, tier three players who actually saw a lot of migrant labor going back, and they struggled after the lockdown was lifted. But this time around, I think that their ability to bounce back is going to be faster. So I think that the ability of the tier one, tier two, tier three players and the ability of the OEMs to bounce back is going to be far more faster. The challenge is going to be in terms of the market this time.
Which is completely the other way around this year, because the challenge then was on the supply side.
Exactly. So last year, we saw a lot of supply side challenges. This year, we are likely to see more of market side challenges.
So Rajiv, we've discussed the domestic market in detail now, but let's also talk about international brands and how they view the Indian market. Now, 2020 and 21 saw big ticket exits from Indian auto, be it General Motors or Harley-Davidson. But there were also new brands entering the market. And these are big global players. So what do you make of this entry and exit scenario and the successes and failures taken together?
So I think that you are right that we saw a lot of exits. But what we should be mindful is that we also saw a lot of entries. That means that there is something in this market which is very, very attractive still for players to keep looking at India as a geography or India as a market. Of course, with the penetration of cars per 1,000 people that we have in our country compared to some of the other comparable geographies, there is definitely a huge potential in terms of growth. The challenge is to get a right pulse of the consumers of the country. So, for example, if you saw some of the players, and I don't want to name or take examples out here, but the thing is that, see, the Indian market is globally aware of what is happening, for example. It's a highly digitized technology driven market. So from an Indian consumer's perspective, if you think of it, the consumer may not have ever bought a car in his family or in his father's family or mother's family or anywhere. And they may be, however, exposed, for example, to smartphones. They would be exposed to doing internet banking. They may be exposed to digital in many, many manners. Now, if this kind of an Indian consumer goes to buy a car, say, which is costing 5 lakhs or 10 lakhs, the expectation that the customer has from that particular product is really very, very high. At the same time, the Indian customers also are shifting gears. I mean, it's not any longer necessarily a small car market in that sense. SUVs have really grown in terms of the size of the market and in terms of value, not in terms of volume, but in terms of value. The value that SUV contributes is already more than the value that comes out of the small cars. So I think some of the players who could get a sense of how the consumers are changing in the country and how's the pulse changing, I think those are the ones who are able to succeed. They could be either the established ones or it is some of the new entrants, but they have got a pulse of how the market is changing. Having worked with a lot of them in terms of their India entry strategies, I think we also learned along with them doing so many surveys, talking to so many consumers, getting a pulse of it. I think the market is changing. However, if you come into the country and say, let me just do a me too, which means that there is someone who's already successful with a particular kind of a product, let me also come with a me too brand, that's not helping in this market. So some people did try to do that, but it did not help them. So I think that from a long-term perspective, this market is going to be no doubt attractive. Some players who come into India don't look at only India as a geography. They also look at India as a base for exports, because it's possible to do manufacturing and assembly at a lower cost here in the country. And also, let's not forget that we are one of those few countries which has right-hand wheel drive. So with the right-hand wheel drives being produced, say in India, you can look at a lot of those Commonwealth countries to whom you can export from India at the same time. So it does help by looking at a strategy for India, which is not just for India, but it is India as a base for maybe a larger market in a sense.
Well, that was a good mini masterclass on market entry strategies too. But speaking of new players and new trends, we have to talk about electrification. Now, that became a very real proposition over the last couple of years, though the market still suffers from the lack of many affordable and accessible EV options. Now, that again is due to a variety of reasons, despite the unit economics being great. Why have we still not reached this inflection point, when EVs can actually become a real mass market proposition? And what's our way ahead for EVs?
Yeah, so Alisha, I think that let's bifurcate between the three segments and say electrification of two-wheelers, electrification of the cars, and electrification of light commercial vehicles. I think electrification of cars, and I'm not touching buses because buses are driven more by consumption by state transport corporations, and they're driven by larger objectives also of pollution reduction and so on. So if you come to two-wheelers, say, from a break-even point perspective today, if you buy an electric two-wheeler vis-a-vis, say, an ICE two-wheeler in the mass market, the break-even point could be anywhere between, say, 4 to 5 years' time. Ideally, if this break-even would have been, say, 3 years, which means that you have to shell a little more money on an electric two-wheeler. But given its running costs are significantly lower, it helps you in terms of recovering those initial investment that you have made, so to say, in, say, 4 to 5 years' time. Now, if this time can come down to 3 years, you will find that there will be a sudden demand coming for electric two-wheelers. And I believe that the beginning is already there. Maybe it is going to be driven by more electric two-wheelers which go in the B2B segment. When I say B2B, I mean that some of the, say, it could be a Pizza Hut or a MACD, or it could be any of these large, or the e-commerce players, right? The Amazon, the Flipkarts and so on, who use two-wheelers for their last mile connectivity, for their home deliveries and so on. Because it's also, from a branding perspective, the best thing for them to do. And it also makes, by the way, a good economic sense for them, because they are the ones who undertake smaller distances. They are the ones who are not going to travel outside the city limits. They're going to remain within the city limits. And they are going to go back and park their vehicles anyways in the night for the haulage next day. So that means that they are the ones who will really drive consumption when it comes to electric two-wheelers to begin with. But as the consumption gets driven by them, we are likely to see a lot of mass or the retail consumers also move towards electric two-wheelers, because one is price point, the other is also from a perspective of confidence. So when you start seeing a lot of electric two-wheelers on the road, it automatically drives people towards saying, okay, this is something which is real, this is something which I can start to use now. And that is what is going to drive then the consumption in the mass market when it comes to two-wheelers. So I believe that two-wheelers is very, very close to that inflection point where we could see a shift towards electrification in a major manner. Also, from a charging perspective, it's far more easier because it can be easily charged using a 15 ampere power point that you may have at home, because these typically will not have a very large battery bank. They may have one or two battery packs or three battery packs at the max, which means that even through a 15 ampere switch or a 5 ampere switch, even if it takes a longer time, it may take about, say, 3 hours, 4 hours or 6 hours in some cases to charge. But still, you will be able to charge it over the night, just like your mobile phone, something similar to that, that you use it during the day, in the night you put it for charging. When it comes to four-wheelers, the trend is going to be very much similar. The trend is going to be more through vehicles which are used by, say, the Ola, Uber, which are going to drive consumption to begin with. And then eventually it will move to the mass market. But the inflection point for four-wheelers is some distance away as compared to two-wheelers, maybe 2-3 years away. And light commercial vehicles may move faster, in fact, as compared to passenger vehicles. The reason is because light commercial...
That's also driven by policy.
Yeah, it is policy driven. It could be driven by municipal corporations saying that, okay, they will allow only electric vehicles to be driven within their city limits and so on from a pollution perspective. So I believe that the light commercial vehicles and three-wheelers, similarly three-wheelers also, we are forgetting three-wheelers. Okay, so three-wheelers and light commercial vehicles may move faster than passenger vehicles. But those are the things that I think are likely to happen. Two-wheelers, three-wheelers, light commercial vehicles and passenger vehicles in that order.
And now we have the much anticipated entry of Tesla in the market as well. So that should help the conversation going, even if a large number of us would not find the vehicles very accessible. So to sum things up, Rajiv, what are some big themes going to be in 2021 beyond electrification when it comes to mobility and the auto sector?
Yeah, I think that the customer journey which was there, the entire buying experience that we used to go through, that is going to undergo a major, major shift in this particular industry. And it is going to be both ways. It is not just that the OEMs and the dealers are trying to make that change, but it is also the consumer who will be willing to expect new things and new ways of buying a four-wheeler for that matter. So that is one thing that we should definitely look for. Maybe that in a few years' time from now, we may not be seeing these showrooms and these outlets that we see all around us in the downtown or within the city limits. They will still be there, but they are likely to be there on the outskirts or outside the city limits, and maybe the sizes are going to be larger. So one thing that we should expect is this entire buying behavior which is there the entire journey which is there, that's going to undergo a major, major shift from a perspective of vehicles. I think the second shift that we should look forward to is that the moment we move towards electrification, okay, we are likely to see a larger number of brands come into the market. Because with ICE engines, it's a very, very complex technology. There were fewer number of companies and a lot of branding exercise, a lot of driving experience, for example. The driving experience that you have in a ICE engine, you talk about gears, you talk about the entire shock absorbers. There is noise, heat, vibration in a vehicle. So there are a lot of things as to how do you take that into account and so on. But when it comes to electric vehicles, it's a comparatively easier vehicle to assemble for that matter. The complexity is, yes, with respect to the electronics which is there into it or the battery from where you source and so on and so forth. But otherwise, it's a far more simpler mechanic. I'm a mechanical engineer. I can say that from that perspective, it's a far more simpler product. So that's the reason you may see a lot more new entrants and a lot more new brands. So I think we should also expect a lot of new names to come up as we get towards electrification. So those are the two things I think that we should be watchful for.
So customers can expect new ways of buying, automakers will explore new ways of selling, and there will be a large number of new brands in the market, which always is good news for us and the auto space. Rajiv, thank you so much for your time and for joining us today on the CNBC TV 18 podcast. Great to talk to you and fabulous insights there.
Oh yes, this was fabulous, Alisha. Very glad to be here and thanks everyone.
And on that note, it's a wrap on this edition of the podcast. Do tune in next week for another episode of Smooth Ride on CNBCTV18.com. Thanks very much for listening.